From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with exiled South African writer Brighton Breitenbach. He spent 7 years in prison for violating South Africa's Anti-Terrorism Act. He wrote about those years in his memoir, True Confessions of an Albino Terrorist. His new memoir is about his recent return trip to South Africa. Also today, the recipe for a Hollywood headache. We talk with producer Art Linson about the perils of making feature films. His credits include The Untouchables, Casualties of War, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and This Boy's Life. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Both sides in the American Airlines flight attendant strike say they're glad the walkout is ending. Company Chairman Robert Crandall says he's sure American can now get all its customers to where they're going for Thanksgiving. NPR's Edward Lifson talked with relieved flight attendants in Chicago.
Hundreds of American Airlines flight attendants who had been picketing at O'Hare jumped in the air and embraced each other as word got out that their five-day-old strike had ended. President Clinton spoke with the flight attendants union and with the airlines and said today that both parties had agreed in principle to end the strike and return to the bargaining table with a third-party impartial arbitrator. These 10-year veteran flight attendants say that's what they wanted all along and that their well-organized strike was the only way to get that point across.
We just want to get back to the table, back fairly and honestly, openly, and get back to work and make some money.
American Airlines now will attempt to straighten out its disrupted schedule before the Thanksgiving holiday, one of the busiest times of the year. At O'Hare Airport in Chicago, I'm Edward Lifson reporting.
The Senate Ethics Committee has asked a federal court to order Senator Bob Packwood to hand over personal diaries that he cited in his defense against charges of sexual misconduct. Packwood has said that he wants to protect personal and private information in the diaries, including information about other members of Congress. In its request to the court, the Ethics Committee said that Packwood only refused to surrender the diaries after the committee came across entries relating to possible criminal misconduct on his part. The European Community's top trade negotiator, Sir Leon Britton, is in Washington for 2 days of talks with U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor. The outcome of the meetings will affect the size, shape, and prospects for a new worldwide trade treaty. NPR's John Idstey reports.
President Clinton's success in pushing NAFTA through the Congress has raised expectations that the 7-year-old rewrite of world trade rules under the GATT will meet its December 15th deadline. Still, much depends on the ability of Ambassador Cantor and Sir Leon to overcome the remaining obstacles between the United States and the European Community. Officials say a full range of GATT issues will be on the table during this meeting, from anti-dumping rules to civil aircraft. There are some concerns that differences over protection and subsidies for steel could present a stumbling block, and French reluctance to go along with the EC-US deal to cut agricultural subsidies still threatens the talks. The Europeans want more concessions from the U.S. in textiles and apparel. President Clinton complicated matters by promising U.S. lawmakers during the NAFTA debate that he would work for a lengthy 15-year phase-out of tariffs in that sector, a schedule rejected by most other nations. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
The Dow Industrials lost nearly 24 points today. This is NPR News. UN weapons inspectors who just returned from Iraq said today that they found no immediate evidence that Iraqi troops used chemical weapons against Shiite Muslim dissidents. The inspectors returned with soil, water, and plant samples that may take months to analyze, and the leader of the team said it may not be possible to find out for sure. Dr. Jack Kevorkian is being accused of violating a Michigan law banning assisted suicide. The Right to Die advocate, who's already free on bond awaiting trial, attended another suicide today. Don Gagne reports.
This was the 20th suicide Kevorkian has attended since June of 1990, and the fourth since the Michigan law designed to stop him was enacted earlier this year. In the latest case, 61-year-old Ali Khalili, a medical doctor from Oak Brook, Illinois, died after inhaling carbon monoxide gas in Kevorkian's suburban Detroit apartment building. Khalili suffered from bone cancer. Until last year, he'd been a professor at the Northwestern University Medical School in Wayne County, where Kevorkian is awaiting a February trial for his role in an August suicide. The prosecuting attorney criticized the doctor for flagrantly disregarding state law. In Oakland County, where the latest suicide took place, the prosecutor was already considering charges against Kevorkian for helping a 72-year-old woman die exactly 1 month ago. The doctor, meanwhile, says the Michigan law is unconstitutional. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gonya in Detroit.
Serbia and Montenegro, the two republics that still call themselves Yugoslavia, have blocked all UN aid convoys into eastern Bosnia. The aid convoys tried to resume operations after leaders of all three warring factions in Bosnia agreed not to harm or harass them. A UN spokeswoman said today that the Yugoslav authorities blocked the latest shipments, claiming that they require special authorization that had not been required in the past. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Brighton Breitenbach is a South African poet, painter, and former political prisoner, now living in exile in Paris. He's generally acknowledged as the leading poet writing in Afrikaans, the language associated with white rule. As Lawrence Weschler wrote in The New Yorker, no one elevated the language to such pure beauty, and no one wielded it so devastatingly against the apartheid regime. Breitenbach left his country for Paris in 1960. In exile, he co-founded an anti-apartheid organization. In 1975, that group sent him undercover to South Africa with a forged passport. But the police were on to him. He was imprisoned under the Terrorism Act and served 7 years of a 9-year sentence before he was allowed to return to Paris in 1982. He's just completed his third memoir. His new book, Return to Paradise, is about his 3-month visit to South Africa in 1991 after the African National Congress, which he had been associated with, was unbanned. I asked him if he thought it was possible to fit back into life in South Africa.
Having lived for so long in France, or lived in Europe, or having moved in other parts of Africa, it became a way of life, which I was then reluctant to give up. It has a certain freedom, this rootlessness. And I'd grown maybe not deep roots, but alternative bypassing roots during all those years. I couldn't pretend now that these didn't exist. And then I found that if I were to go back then, perhaps even now, I would inevitably become very heavily involved in what was happening in the country. And that would be very time-consuming and would perhaps also even be very frustrating and tiring and enervating. Because I think that, as with so many other countries going through a like situation, there are a lot of arguments, conditions nearly, that have to be gone through before people can come to an even keel again and continue with their lives.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to your early history. You dropped out of college in South Africa to leave your country.
Mm-hmm.
You ended up in Paris, where you were, mm-hmm. you know, living as an exile. Why did you want to leave South Africa?
I wanted, on the one hand, I studied painting, and I wanted to get to where I thought the heartland of painting was. That was Paris. I was close to friends, a little bit older than I, who had just returned from Paris after a long stay. I was very impressed and envious of what they'd gone through. And of course, like everybody else living far away from Europe, I was following through art publication was happening. I thought that's where it was, and that's where I wanted to go. But also, I was at the University of Cape Town, which was one of the few so-called liberal universities that was still to some extent integrated. In other words, I had a certain number of so-called black or colored or Indian students, and I found myself in class with them, and we socialized, we became friends. I got to understand them a little bit. And I certainly identified with a lot of their problems, and in any event, the university as such was then involved in resisting a law that was segregating universities, but to take away all the so-called non-white students. And we manifested against that. I got into troubles because of it, like many other people did. I had been called in by the police twice. I had been warned that I was going to get my fingers burnt. I certainly also knew a certain number of people who were already involved in political activity of a heavier kind underground, so-called African resistance movement. The place was quite hot, Cape Town. It was boiling. Many things were in the air. So there was certainly that, although it's not anything as structured or as deeply committed as it became later on. And I can't say I left because I was forced out for political reasons, but I certainly was very aware that I was starting to move into an area that was becoming dangerous.
In Paris, you co-founded an anti-apartheid group, and it was decided that you would go on behalf of this group to South Africa on a mission undercover with a fake passport and a fake name.
Yes.
And it was on that trip that you were arrested and then imprisoned for about 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
You were pretty well known. I mean, you were pretty well known as a writer already in South Africa. Do you think it was a bad choice to choose you to be the person going undercover?
Yeah, it's a little bit, but it's also, you know, had I gone and come out again, everybody would have thought it would have been a perfectly normal thing to do. It's a little bit of second guessing.
Mm-hmm.
We had sent in many people, not many, we'd sent in quite a few into the country before, and we'd been lucky. We thought we'd worked out the logistics of how to do it. We also had brought out quite a fair number of people and would spend time with us abroad whom we'd given training, and then they'd return to the country. So this was not exactly breaking new ground. And we were fairly, despite, you know, what is now being said, we did go to quite some lengths to disguise our movements and ourselves, etc. I'm not so very sure that it was the fact of me going back that made my arrest inevitable, whether it wouldn't have happened anyway, whether it was and somebody else going in under that name. I think it was rather a case of what we were doing then coming to a point where it would become really significant and perhaps significantly dangerous, on the one hand to the state that we were combating, on the other hand perhaps to allies whom we were working with, who didn't want perhaps to see rivals doing things that they thought they ought to be doing.
Do you think you were set up?
I think I must have been. I'm not sure whether I was set up. I think I was definitely sold out. Set up? No. I took a very strong personal part in making the decision to go. Nobody forced me to do so. So it couldn't be that. The setup part may come to the extent that somebody knowing beforehand where I was going to be or when I was going to be in the country may have passed on the information.
So you think that somebody did sell you out, that someone passed on the information that you were there undercover, making it easy for the authorities to find you?
I think so. Well, you know, it's a murky world, that world. It was double dealing and double guessing and all the rest of it. I've given up a long time ago trying to find out who or what had caused the arrest, because it's not the kind of information that anybody, even if it were in his possession, would let me have without wanting to exploit it or to manipulate me through it.
When you were imprisoned, you pled guilty to charges of terrorism and apologized for the, quote, ridiculous and stupid things that you had done. Why did you decide to plead guilty?
Oh, I pleaded guilty because I had a choice of either pleading guilty to that particular charge sheet or being convicted of a very much heavier charge sheet, which included things like nuclear spying, smuggling people and arms across the border, acts of armed sabotage, all of which the state would have made stick, although none of it were true. We are talking of a totalitarian state. We're talking of a state that decides what it wants to find you guilty of. And what you yourself have done or not done is totally insignificant. It makes no difference. I was, in short, given a choice of being convicted to be executed or to be convicted for lesser crimes with carrying a minimum sentence of 5 years. And on my side, the implicit promise that I will not make a political trial after trial, which is what they wanted to avoid at all costs, Not that I necessarily understood all the reasons why it was so important for them to avoid it. And on their side, the promise that they would release all the other people that had been arrested with me, or after my arrest. And this indeed did happen. Not a single one of them. I mean, they were arrested and detained, but not a single one of them were taken to court or sentenced for anything. As for apologizing, well, you know, I think one has to go back and read it clearly within its context. It's not quite the way it comes across now. I don't think I've ever at any point denied my convictions. And if I apologize for certain stupid things, well, they were so patently stupid. The very fact that I'm standing in court was a proof of patent stupidity. The apology was not necessarily directed at the state.
So did you compose your statement in such a way so that you would be able to say it and know in your heart of hearts what you were admitting to and what you weren't?
Yes, to some extent. First of all, you know, it's not something one can talk about to people who haven't been through anything similar. I suppose you'd have to go and find, one would have to go and find somebody from the Soviet Union or from the time of the Slansky trials in Czechoslovakia or a modern day other countries where this kind of thing may still happen, still be going on, to have any beginning of an understanding of what the relationship between a detainee being interrogated and his interrogator may be. There's a fair and a very thorough amount of brainwashing going on, obviously. I have no qualms about what I did there then. I'm not sure that I wouldn't be doing exactly the same under other circumstances. I, in fact, have no patience whatsoever with, you know, as we say in Afrikaans, with those standing on the shore giving very good advice to him or her who was drowning. I didn't certainly intend to go and let myself be strung from a gallows just to satisfy vicariously the need for moral satisfaction by a lot of do-gooders abroad. And as for the commitment to the struggle, as for the commitment to my convictions, these have never changed. I don't think I dented them in any way. I don't think I fooled anybody who really knew me. I unfortunately doesn't even see me if I particularly fooled those whom I try to fool to some extent, that is the state or the interrogators facing me. And I continued in some form by other means to fight the same battle.
So there was kind of a bargain that if you handled yourself a certain way, that the government would give you a lighter sentence and release other people who were involved. Do you feel that they completely held up their end
of
the bargain?
No, of course not. Of course not. But then neither did I. You know, it was a fool's deal to start with. So I suppose I can't blame too badly for that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is exiled South African writer Brighton Breitenbach. He's written a new memoir about his 1991 return to South Africa. It's called Return to Paradise. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is exiled South African writer Brighton Breitenbach. Something else, and I'm not asking this to pass judgment, but I just I'm curious about it. While you were in jail, you wrote to the head of the security police offering to inform in exchange for a quicker release.
I should imagine that the very fact that they produced this during trial was a clear indication of their seeing right through that particular attempt. If they had the slightest feel, the slightest hope that I was serious in presenting something like this, they would never have made this public. And so they did their second best, smear me with it. No, I have no problems with that either. I can say with total satisfaction that I've never betrayed anybody, and which is quite contrary from a fair number of people whom I know, some of whom are sitting in the very highest councils of the ANC at the moment.
What would you have done if the police said, okay, you've got a deal?
I would have gone out and I would have immediately denounced the deal the moment I would have been in safety anywhere out of their reach.
Doesn't it work the other way around, though, that you have to name names first and then they deliver you to safety?
Well, probably that's why I never got out. Maybe, I mean, even they knew that I wasn't willing to do. They never asked me for that, and I suppose so. We never even got to that step. No, I don't think it would have worked that way. No, in any case, we never got to. We wouldn't have. There wasn't any chance of getting that far. No, I don't think so. You know, after all, while this was going on, if you want to take the trouble, you can go and do some research, some other letters, some of which were intercepted and were reproduced at various points. I smuggled out of prison, saying exactly what was going on and giving exact information as to who was in danger outside and who I thought may be a danger to people and what they should look out for. So they probably knew this also. It was not quite as easy as it sounds. I think people live in a kind of a make-believe world, that what they retain from all these experiences, or what seemed to excite them endlessly, would be these little things that you're talking about now.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of statement in court. I don't know. Must be some kind of picking of the nose, I should imagine. But it doesn't particularly strike me as being something that is of much interest.
I hope you don't misinterpret my questions. I'm not trying to ask you to pass judgment. It's just that so many of the people who I've interviewed have been political prisoners talk about things about how you can't admit to anything, and you can never cut a deal because they'll, you know, with the authorities, because they'll turn on you anyways. And I find it really interesting that you took a different course when you were in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there are other people who have done that but haven't talked about it. Do you know what I mean? So it's just very interesting for me to hear
mm-hmm.
why you did what you did, which is different from what most other political prisoners have discussed with us on the program.
Maybe.
So
I don't know.
I'm not asking you to try to pass judgment, but rather to...
Oh, I don't pass judgment on anything. I mean, I don't... In fact, I couldn't care a damn for judgments that other people pass. But really, I could not care one moment about what... you know, the kind of life I have led, or perhaps even to some extent been born into... I've known from very young on is going to make me fairly unacceptable to a very large number of people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm terminally politically incorrect. So it doesn't bother me at all. It doesn't. It's no skin of my nose. And whatever judgment anybody may make, you or anybody else, is not going to make any difference to what I feel or what I continue doing. As for what other political prisoners may or may not have gone through, I think the only people whom I would perhaps, it may sound very arrogant, deign to really talk to about these matters would be other political prisoners. And I can assure you we talk about it in quite a different way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Your father, when you were in prison, wrote a letter to Prime Minister Voerster
mm-hmm.
asking for leniency on your behalf. And Voerster
mm-hmm.
wrote that it was an old phenomenon in Afrikaner families for one son to be a traitor
mm-hmm.
and one to be a hero. And I know that your older brother
mm-hmm.
was, I believe, like the most decorated member of the South African Defense Force, a founder
mm-hmm.
of the Defense Force's Special Forces Unit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a great upholder of, mm-hmm. of the apartheid system. Does it seem typical to you to have that in Afrikaner families in the way that Voerster said it is, you know?
Well, you had a civil war too, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
You had a civil war too, didn't you?
Yes, yes, yes.
And you must have had times, even during the Vietnam War, when people in the same family went diametrically opposite directions.
Absolutely.
No, I don't think this is so. Well, if I may be a little bit cynical about it, it's the kind of thing that can only happen in an Afrikaner family, because the English-speaking families, white families, don't necessarily ever become involved enough in the situation in the country to have to make a decision either way. They are riding nicely whichever way the dice fall. But it is true that to the extent that the Afrikaners are rooted, whether they like it or not, in that part of the world, and to the extent that they have nowhere else to go, and to the extent that they tend to perhaps involve themselves in whatever they believe in fairly radically, that this kind of a rift will appear from time to time. It happens in quite a lot of families.
Do you think your parents thought of you as a traitor?
I should never think so, no. Certainly not. Certainly not. No, you know, it's a different thing when you are there, when you're on the ground. It doesn't work that way. I think we tend to romanticize these things so terribly that we end up with totally false impressions. Do you think in the hearts of hearts that the parent would ever consider his or her child a traitor? I can't imagine that.
In the introduction to your book, you refer to what you think is a new politically correct orthodoxy in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
You've said before that you're kind of hopelessly politically incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
What's the new politically correct orthodoxy that you're referring to?
People's power, let's put it that way. It's perhaps taking a bit of a shortcut, although I also very strongly believe in people's power, but I think I understand something quite different from it. The idea of vanguardism, the idea that you will have an elite of people who know what the answers are and who will bit by bit feed the necessary information perhaps to the masses as they grow into adulthood enough to understand and to be manipulated properly. The new political correctness would be, for the time being, I think, a rejection of anything that may be labeled as reflecting a set of norms or standards which are considered to be elitist or exclusive. It would be the kind of thing, for instance, that would put heavy demands on people to be writing social realist works and not to go off into absconds and obscure sideways and byways like somebody like, for instance, J.M. Coetzee might do. There's an attempt, I think, to rewrite history, to reinterpret history. There is perhaps also an effort to pretend that some of the things we saw horribly go wrong elsewhere didn't really happen and will certainly not happen here, so that we are gearing ourselves for making the same mistakes. There are many of these things, particularly a certain intolerance of difference, a certain intolerance of dissidents particularly, which, by the way, I think is going to create a whole new generation of dissidents.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Pleasure indeed.
Brighton Breitenbach's new memoir is called Return to Paradise. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Art Linson is a movie producer who knows that producers aren't held in the highest esteem. When he asked David Mamet to help him define producer, Mamet offered Ivan the Terrible on a car phone and greed untempered by reason. Coming up, we talk with Linson about what a Hollywood producer really does. It's the subject of his memoir, A Pound of Flesh. Linson produced the films This Boy's Life, Casualties of War, The Untouchables, Point of No Return, Singles, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and Car Wash. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Ethics Committee has issued a statement that sharply repudiates suggestions from Senator Alan Simpson that committee staffers leaked information to the Justice Department, prompting it to subpoena Senator Bob Packwood's diaries last week. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
Appearing on TV yesterday, Simpson accused the Senate Ethics Committee staff of leaking the possibility of a Packwood resignation to the Department of Justice in an unauthorized and spiteful action. But today, the Ethics Committee released a statement declaring that all its contacts with the Justice Department had been authorized, proper, and required under the rules of the committee. The statement said the committee, contacted by the Justice Department last week, voted unanimously to refer to the department a matter involving Packwood and possible criminal wrongdoing. That afternoon, FBI agents served Packwood with a subpoena for his diaries and other records so that if he resigned, he would not be free to destroy them. After the subpoena was served, Packwood decided not to resign, and today the Senate Ethics Committee filed papers in federal court to enforce its subpoena of his diaries. A hearing was set for December 16th. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Also on Capitol Hill, a joint House Senate Conference Committee has approved a compromise version of the Brady Handgun Control Bill. However, it's not certain if the Senate will be able to approve it this year. Most senators have left Washington, and the only way to gain Senate approval is by voice vote with no objections. Alaska's Republican Senator Ted Stevens says he's unhappy with the final language of the bill and might object. The House has approved a campaign financing reform plan that places voluntary limits on what candidates for Congress can spend on their campaigns. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The plan puts a $600,000 ceiling on what congressional candidates can spend, although if the candidate has a primary and/or runoff, that limit could be over $1 million. Candidates could get no more than a third of their contributions from special interest groups. In return for abiding by the voluntary limits, candidates would receive up to $200,000 in public funds. Campaign reform was a priority of freshman lawmakers, including New York Democrat Carolyn Maloney.
It is extremely difficult to pass legislation that literally makes it more difficult for incumbents to get reelected. And that is exactly what this bill does.
Several obstacles must be overcome before the measure reaches the president. A public funding mechanism must be developed, and negotiators will have to work out the differences between the House plan and a very different Senate bill. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 24 points to close at 3,670.25 on volume of more than 277 million shares. This is NPR News. President Clinton announced this afternoon that a strike at American Airlines is over, and both sides have agreed to go back to the bargaining table. Mr. Clinton said that he had talked with both sides and they have agreed to binding arbitration in a contract for some 21,000 flight attendants. A walkout started last Thursday, stranding thousands of people and costing the airline millions of dollars. The president said all of those on strike will be allowed to return to their jobs. Contract talks broke down over a number of issues, including staffing, work rules, schedules, and health benefits. The walkout came at the busiest time of the year for U.S. Airlines. In South Africa, three young men accused of murdering an American exchange student have been released from prison. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports from Cape Town.
Amy Bill, a white American exchange student in South Africa, was killed on the eve of her scheduled return to the United States in August. She was stabbed to death after she dropped off some black friends in a black township, allegedly because she was white. Late this afternoon, the three teenagers charged with her death were released. The police cited a lack of evidence. The case ran into trouble when the key witness withdrew his testimony. A crowd of supporters shouting, "One settler, one bullet," greeted the teens as they walked out of prison. Charges are still pending against four others in the case, and the investigation is continuing. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Cape Town.
The government had a budget deficit in October of more than $45 billion. The Treasury Department says the government spent $124 billion in the first month of the new fiscal year, and revenues came to less than $79 billion. The fiscal year 1993, the government had a deficit of just under $255 billion compared to more than $290 billion the year before. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Art Linson is a Hollywood producer. You may think he spends his time barking orders and making money hand over fist. Don't fool yourself, he says. He's always in the position of asking studios for money, asking agents for talent, even asking the director for permission to visit the set. Linson produced the films Car Wash, American Hot Wax, Melvin and Howard, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Scrooged, The Untouchables, Casualties of War, Singles, This Boy's Life, and The Point of No Return. For most of his films, he originated the idea and found the writer, director, and studio backing. His new memoir about the perils of producing movies in Hollywood is called A Pound of Flesh. I particularly enjoyed his story of producing The Untouchables. Here's how he developed the idea.
I was brought over to Paramount to produce and develop material for them. And one of the things that they owned was the television series The Untouchables. And my feeling about it was that this could make a great movie if we didn't try to make it the way the television series made it, but try to lift it to another level. And they said, we'd love to make a movie about The Untouchables. We have no interest particularly in lifting it to another level, but do whatever you want. And I thought one of the ways to achieve that would be to try to get a very stylish, high-quality writer who you wouldn't ordinarily think would do a television series, remake a television series, but could maybe lend something special to it. And one of the writers that I thought would be great for this was David Mamet, particularly because I knew he was from Chicago, and the folklore of Elliot Ness and Al Capone is sort of a mainstay in Chicago, and I thought he might be attracted to the subject matter, you know, notwithstanding the television series. So I set up a meeting with him, and I sat with him, and I was trying to figure out how I would convince him to do The Untouchables, and in the end, I just thought I'd just be straight and honest about it and said, "Listen, David, you don't know me, but I know you just won the Pulitzer Prize for writing the play Glengarry Glen Ross. Don't you think it would be great to just make a whole lot of money from Hollywood and write the screenplay to The Untouchables?" And I thought, you know, like some people after winning the Pulitzer might say, "Oh, my God, money, please. You know, check, please. Can I get out of here?" But he just sort of turned to me and he went, "Okay." And that was sort of the end of the meeting. He agreed right there to do it. He liked the idea, and he went ahead and wrote a screenplay, which was substantially different from the television series. And he almost created like an operatic little tale of the teacher of Elliot Ness, who sacrifices his life to try to go after Al Capone, and that's the character that Sean Connery made so famous. And that screenplay really sort of dictated the future of that movie. And what I mean by that is it ended up attracting Brian De Palma to direct it. It ended up attracting Kevin Costner, who, even though he wasn't a movie star at the time, was still very selective about what he wanted to do.
Now, let me stop you. Oh, yeah. No, go ahead.
And of course it attracted Sean Connery and Robert De Niro. So the script was a very significant vehicle in determining what that movie ended up becoming.
Now, here's an interesting producer headache that you had. You had your screenwriter, David Mamet. You had your director, Brian De Palma. But De Palma decided that there were certain script changes that were needed. Mamet thought that he'd given you all the revisions that he was required to. He was working on directing his own movie, didn't have any time to do more revisions. And so explain.
Oh, he had the, David had the time. He didn't have the inclination.
Okay.
I mean, David writes too fast not to have the time. He could do it between, you know, courses at dinner. The fact is that, you know, David's a special case. He's a playwright who is extremely independent and has another career. He doesn't have to perhaps be as polite as other screenwriters in Hollywood have to be because, you know, if he's... You know, he can always go and write plays. So he was very difficult, and he wrote a sequence that took place on a series of crashing trains that when we tried to figure out how to do it in Chicago, it was, oh, God, an extra $10 million to the budget. It was, like, preposterous with a series of train crashes and everything. And we had to restage some of the sequences in another way and had to have it rewritten. And Mamet would have none of it. And, of course, you know, the producer's the one that has to march out and do the begging again. And I flew to Seattle to meet with David to say, which he said, I said, listen, David, I need some changes. I'd like to come out and talk to you about it. And he says, hey, get on a plane. Come and see me. I flew to Seattle and met him. And I said, so let's have a talk about the script. He goes, oh, the script. And, gosh, I'm not really prepared to do anything about the script. I went, I flew to Seattle for you to tell me you're not doing the rewrite. He goes, yeah, and you could tell that. That Italian, that fat Italian director, I mean, I ain't doing no more work. So that's what David did. So I went back, and Brian and I were left with the shambles of having to sort of recreate some of the sequences, one of which turned out to be that step sequence that Brian came up with from brilliantly designed and created by Brian, which is the shootout on the steps that he sort of took from the Potemkin movie. And another is a sequence in the opera sequence where nobody speaks, but it's conveyed very clearly that Al Capone is connected to the murder.
Yeah, so, and in the book you explained that you had to do the new sequences without dialogue because no one can write that dialogue that matches Mamet's dialogue.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's why the opera sequence, people are whispering in people's ears, but you can't hear what they're saying.
Okay, let's get to the actors. Now, you wanted Robert De Niro and you wanted Sean Connery, and they wanted more money than your studio was willing to give them. So explain how they each managed to sign up anyways.
Well, Sean Connery wasn't in that case. He expected more money, and we offered him very little. But he saw this as a great vehicle for him, and he immediately agreed to do it. And he ended up winning an Academy Award for it.
Mm-hmm.
De Niro, on the other hand, wanted a lot of money, and Brian and I were desperate to get De Niro. The studio just wouldn't go for it. And about 4 weeks before we were ready to start shooting, they said, listen, you're going to have to make a decision. And we decided to hire Bob Hoskins instead of De Niro. But about 2 weeks to go before we were ready to start, Brian, you know, was very blue about it and said, look, we've got to get De Niro. And both of us felt very strongly, how often do you have a chance of getting Al Capone to be played by Bob De Niro? So we had the studio executives fly to Chicago. Our budget was going massively over, and they were coming there to say that if we don't cut down the budget, they're going to cancel the movie. And we had some news for them, and when they arrived, we had a general meeting, and they said, you're going to have to cut the picture back, or we're not going to make it. And Brian said, well, I got to be honest with you right now. We're not only going to not cut it back. If you don't make it with Bob De Niro, we're not prepared to make the movie. So there was a brief impasse, and the result was that Bob Hoskins was removed from the picture. We paid him off, and we hired Bob at his salary. And the rest is, on the screen.
God, I can't imagine how many aspirins you must take during the course of
a movie. I got to say, I saw my career flash in front of my eyes on several occasions on that movie.
Yeah, yeah. You're just joining us. My guest is film producer Art Linson. He has a new memoir called A Pound of Flesh, Perilous Tales of How to Produce Movies in Hollywood. We're going to take a short break, then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is movie producer Art Linson, and he has a new book about his adventures producing movies called A Pound of Flesh. So I found your description of working with De Niro fascinating. You know, I've seen him on enough talk shows to know that De Niro off-screen isn't at all like he is on-screen. And when you first met him, you thought, this is an imposter. How can he possibly play those roles? This isn't him.
Well, one of the things that happened that, you know, is very amusing, actually, is that, you know, we went through it such a horrible time to get Bob to be in the picture. I mean, it required paying Bob Hoskins off completely.
Mm-hmm.
It expanded the budget. The studio was mad, but they had no alternative but to go forward because they had now spent so much money to get in that they needed to make the movie. After all that, I had yet to meet Bob. So finally the deal was done, and he flew into Chicago. We were about to make the picture, where he wanted to meet us, look at his wardrobe, and then go off to Italy to gain 25 pounds so he could be Capone. So he came in to meet everybody, and it was about 11, 12 o'clock at night, and we were at the hotel, and De Palma said, okay, he's here. Come on up. He wants to talk. So the three of us, I come in the room, the two of them are there, and I see what purportedly was Bob De Niro, this kind of very small, self-effacing guy on the couch, very shy, dressed in absolute clothes that would keep him as, you know, he could walk into a 7-Eleven and be unrecognized. And he was very quiet and said, I'd like to look at some of the wardrobe, and, you know, I've got some thoughts about the script. And he was very, very quiet, very unassuming, looked like he could blow him over the feather. And it was a brief half-hour meeting, and I remember going back down to my hotel room and immediately calling De Palma up and going, my God, this guy is going to play Al Capone? I mean, he said, if you didn't, you know, I'd like to get some fingerprints on him to make sure it's De Niro. This guy isn't going to scare, you know, the birds away. And he goes, nope, it's Bob. He says, and he says, even when you see him do it, it won't look like much until you see the dailies, until you see him on screen, and then you'll get it. And sure enough, that's exactly what happened.
So even when he was performing, it didn't look right? Wasn't
No, it's special. It's special when he's performing. But I mean, it's even more spectacular when you see it blown up on the screen. I mean, he's just got a spectacular instinct for creating the kind of excitement that he does.
Well, let's go back to the aspirin bottle for a minute. After after you get De Niro and you're convinced, okay, it's really him after all, in spite of the fact that he's so meek-looking, he looks at the wardrobe and he decides he needs a completely different wardrobe than the wardrobe you have. You're already massively over budget. So what was wrong with the wardrobe that you had, and what did it cost to go along with his changes?
Well, actually, Bob is so polite that he really, I was just getting to know him. It was only the second day that we had spoken, and he doesn't really, you know, comment that directly. We went to the set, and he tried on all of the wardrobe, and then he called me in, and it's wardrobe that was designed by Armani. It was, you know, an enormous amount of money was spent on it. And it was spent, actually, with the thought that probably Bob Hoskins was going to be wearing it. And he tried everything on, and he asked if he could speak to me. And I said, sure. I came into his trailer, and he took me aside, and he goes, I said, so how's everything going? How do you like the wardrobe? And he goes, I like it. He goes, I said, did you try everything on? He goes, yeah. I tried every single piece on, which he did. It was hours. And I said, so how do you like it? He goes, I like it. I said, so let me get this straight. What you really want me to do is get rid of all of this wardrobe, throw it away, and you want to start over with somebody else. You hate it. He goes, exactly. And I said, okay, we'll do it. And that's exactly what we did. I mean, he never once said he didn't like it. I could just tell by the look on his face. He was miserable. And he ended up recreating, you know, Capone's wardrobe, actually with some of the authentic tailors that dressed Al Capone. I mean, he went to Sulca and got the robes that Capone used. And, I mean, he was, as usual, Bob was as exacting and as specific as anybody you can imagine. And as soon as I was willing to replace the wardrobe, we became great friends.
Were you happy with the movie?
I was. I mean, not with every aspect of it, quite honestly, but it was an excellent movie, yes.
Movie producer Art Linson is my guest. His new memoir is called A Pound of Flesh. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. President Kennedy was assassinated 30 years ago today. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what are you doing on the assassination on All Things Considered?
Well, we're going to play President Kennedy's inaugural address today. And then we're going to hear from a couple who were so inspired by JFK that they decided to devote their lives to government and public service. We'll hear how they recall what they thought then and what they think now of JFK. Also today, we'll hear what sent the flight attendants back to work at American Airlines. And also, we'll hear about a group that composes and performs Jewish music. It's called Tzimis.
Thanks, Robert. Then and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Producer Art Linson is my guest. Some of the movies he's produced include This Boy's Life, Point of No Return, Casualties of War, The Untouchables, Singles, We're No Angels, Fast Times at Ridgemont High, Car Wash, and American Hot Wax. We were talking about The Untouchables, which Brian De Palma directed. Another movie that you did with him was Casualties of War. Now, this was a movie set in Vietnam during the war. Michael J. Fox was the lead. And this is a movie I like very much, and I like Michael J. Fox's performance in it very much. Nevertheless, I always wondered whether that was a selection that the studio asked for or one that was already on your A-list, because Michael J. Fox at that time was, I think, one of those real commercially bankable actors. And I know sometimes studios say, well, if you want to make the movie, you've got to choose from this list of big commercially bankable people.
Terry, you know more about Hollywood than I do.
This is this is not true?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, look, the Casualties of War was another example of, by the way, a screenplay written by a playwright, David Rabe.
Mm-hmm.
The casting of Michael J. Fox was clearly a commercial choice that the studio wanted, and it was the kind of screenplay that without a piece of casting like that, we couldn't have gotten the money to make the film.
Mm-hmm.
So to take nothing away from Michael J. Fox, I knew early on as we were making the film that it was going to be hard for the public to want to see Michael in such a compromised, difficult situation. And it was hard for them. It's not taking anything away from the performance that he did, because I thought he did a very, very good job. But there's no question that the audience has they want to see Michael funny. Michael in pain is not anything that they want to see, you know. So but in fact, even in a helmet, I don't even think anybody wants to see. But I thought he did an admirable job. In fact, I think it's one of his best performances.
I agree with you. Let me ask you about testing, and this is the kind of testing where you show the movie or the movie in progress to an invited audience who then gets to answer a lot of questions about their reaction to the film. I've heard many people complain about this process. I've heard a few people defend it as actually very useful feedback to have. Do you find it useful?
It can be useful. In most cases it can be very destructive, but it can be useful. One of the tricks, the preview process for the filmmakers is one of the worst things anybody has to go through, because after 3 years of being on a movie and doing everything you can to make it as good as you can, suddenly you're sitting in front of 300 people in Sacramento who fill out cards, and then we have a focus group of the 20 of them, and they're suddenly telling the studios how they would like to see the ending changed. And the studios immediately respond to it, and serious results, usually negative, result from that process.
You're producing a movie. You're satisfied with say the ending's a little ambiguous or something, and you like it that way. You've just tested the movie, and the cards are coming back saying, nah, we wanted it to be happier. It would be better if it was happier. And the studio's saying to you, you really need to change this ending. It's too ambiguous. It's not going to work. Are you in any position to fight it? I mean, have you had to defend what you think is
the
truer
ending?
Well,
you have a partnership here. I mean, mm-hmm. after all, somebody's just put up $20 million for your movie.
Right.
They've got, 15 kids in the front row saying, gosh, if Mary would only just drive away in the Chevy. And an executive is looking at that saying, well, what if they're right? I mean, my God, this one mistake may bury us. I mean, so it's a pressure situation. And frankly, it isn't a question of having the power as much as the ability to try to argue your case. You can't expect somebody who puts up that kind of money not to be afraid for their investment. They're mm-hmm. continually afraid for their mm-hmm. investment. And you know, and taking risks like putting up, like being having an ambiguous ending, or having a movie that needs violence and expresses itself in a violent way, or you know, a whole variety of things that could be a little controversial. The preview process will immediately pick up as being controversial. And one of the worst previewed movies in the history of previews was Goodfellas. You know, Martin Scorsese's movie. They couldn't get anybody to fill out a card to say they liked the movie because it was so violent. It was an enormously successful movie. I mean, one of his most successful movies he ever directed. And the guy that previewed the movie ultimately had to say, well, I called that wrong. You know, we previewed it and it was wrong. They're wrong all of the time. I mean, it's remarkable how often they're wrong. And so that doesn't mean that what if the preview process isn't useful, it means that it has to be used very cautiously, and then it can be useful.
Did you ever really take a bath on a film?
Me personally? Some studios have, sure. I mean, I'm glad you listed most of my hits, but I mean, yes. Yes, they've taken a couple of baths on some.
Does it shake your confidence when that happens?
Listen, my confidence is shaken, you know, every week in Hollywood. So, yes, of course it shakes your confidence. You feel terrible about it. I just put out a movie called This Boy's Life, which I loved and thought it was, you know, and still think it's a terrific movie. I mean, you know, I couldn't pay people to walk across the street to see it if I offered to give them free parking and food. And it was just one of those pictures that could have and should have done better, but didn't. And the studio ended up losing money.
What are you working on now? What's your pet project now?
Well, I'm developing a couple of movies for Warner Brothers that I'm excited about. One is a movie called Catwalk, which is a romantic thriller that takes place in Paris. An American girl goes back to try to retrieve the dead body of her famous model sister, and she gets into sort of a charade-type movie, and hopefully that's going to start at the beginning of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just back, after this book tour, back to doing what I've always had to do, which is develop material and beg people to make the movies.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for sharing with us some of what it is that you do, and I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Terry.
Art Linson's new memoir about producing movies is called A Pound of Flesh. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Naomi Person directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation and the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, dressing mod, smashing guitars, and making great music. We talk with Pete Townsend about his life before, during, and after The Who. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.